This review covers Chapter 4, First, Demand, Supply, and Markets, and Chapter 3, Second, Economic Decision Makers.
So let's get started here with the market system. First of all, what is a market? A market is a group of buyers and sellers with potential to trade. One of the reasons why it's important to define what a market is that in economics, if it's not happening at the market, then we're not really concerned about it. For example, if we came out with a fertility drug and the number of cows born in the United States doubled, would the supply of cows double? And the answer is no, not necessarily, because unless those extra cows are brought to market, then we don't measure it in economics. So we are only concerned with what is occurring at the market. We're not so much concerned about how many cows we have standing in 4 feet, but what we're concerned about is how many cows are brought to market. So so economics is really the study of markets. Now, in the market, you've got demand and you've got supply. So what is demand? Demand is a relation showing the quantities of a good consumers are willing and able to buy at various prices during a given period of time, other things constant. So let's look at this definition a little more closely here. Demand is a relation showing the quantities of a good consumers are willing and able. So the demand curve is not a wish list type of thing, but it shows us how many units consumers are willing and able in terms of can they afford it or do they want to buy it. It takes both a want to and the ability to buy for someone to actually demand a product or service. Okay, other things constant. When we change price in economics, we always assume that nothing else changes. You know, for example, I might say price of Cadillac cars goes down by, let's say, 20%. So what's going to happen? And you might say, well, you know, if the price is 20% less, then I guess people would buy more. Well, yeah, so we can come to that conclusion, but only if we assume that nothing else changes. In other words, if the price goes down by 20% and people's preference for cars don't change, their incomes don't change, the size of the market doesn't change, expectations don't change, then yes, we can say that that people will buy more cars if the price goes down by 20%. But what would happen, for example, if the price of other luxury cars went down by 50%? Or let's say people's incomes on the average went down by 50%. Would they necessarily buy more Ford car? More Cadillacs if the price goes down by 20%? If the price of other luxury cars went down by 50%, or if their incomes went down by 50%? So if we're going to come to the conclusion that when the price goes down, people will buy more, we must make the assumption that other things are constant. Everything else stays the same. Sometimes there's a Greek term here called ceteris paribus. Which means everything else being equal. So keep that in mind now. When price changes, we always assume that nothing else changes. Okay, so what is a demand curve? A curve showing the quantities of commodity demanded at various possible prices, other things constant. So what we're talking about here is various prices. How many units will be demanded at various prices? So What is a change in the quantity demanded?
Change in quantity demanded?
Welcome.
How are you?
All right, so you come for the for this lecture.
Well, I got to get you to sign something for me. You're like my advisor or something like that.
Okay, well, I got to get through with this.
Yeah.
So what is a change in the quantity demanded? A movement along a demand curve in response to a change in the price, other things constant. Okay, when price changes, what this is saying is that we're moving along a stationary demand curve, but the curve itself does not change. So when price changes, we're moving along a stationary curve. So what is changing here is the quantity demanded, but not demand itself. Now, in order for demand to change, then something has to change other than price. And we'll look at that in here in just a few moments. So why are demand curves, why do they have a negative slope? Why are they downward sloping? Because as the price goes up, people tend to buy less, so the quantity demanded goes down. If the price goes down, people tend to buy more, so the quantity demanded goes up. So this shows us an inverse relationship between price and quantity. And an inverse relationship can only be illustrated by a negatively sloped or a downward sloping curve. So all demand curves have this negative slope. Okay, I'm looking over these slides here. What is market demand? Market demand is a sum of the individual demands of all consumers in the market. So in macroeconomics, we're concerned with aggregate demand. So how do we come up with aggregate demand? Well, we take individual demands and we add them up horizontally, and this is what is called market demand. Okay. All right, so let me just give you some definitions here before we get into some other aspects of this demand and supply. First of all, what is a normal good? A normal good is a good that people buy more of as their income increases. You might say, well, don't people buy more of everything as their incomes increase? Well, the answer to that is no, because an inferior good is actually a good that people buy less of as their incomes increase. Like what? Well, if people's incomes increase, they might buy more new cars, But they'll buy fewer used cars. So a new car would be a normal good. A used car would be what is called an inferior good. Okay, so what are complements? Goods that are related in such a way that an increase in the price of one leads to a decrease in the demand for the other. Now what we're getting at here is that What can affect demand is a change in the price of a related product. Now, when goods are complements, that means that that an increase in the price of one leads to a decrease in the demand for the other. In other words, if two goods are complements, that means that they go together. Like gasoline and automobiles, or printers and paper, or printers and ink, things that go together, shrimp and shrimp sauce, steak and steak sauce. We say that certain things are complements. Now, when things are related, they can be related either in one of two ways, either as complements or as substitutes. Now, if they're related as complements, if they go together, then, for example, if the price of steak goes up, what happens to the demand for steak sauce? Well, you think about that. If the price of steak goes up, now let's see, the quantity demanded for steak will go down, but as people are buying less steak, then they will tend to buy less demand sauce. So the demand for steak sauce will go down as people buy less steak. Now, if things are substitutes, then this works in the opposite way. That means that two things are related in terms of one can be used instead of another. Up to a certain price, lots of things have substitutes. So if the price of a substitute changes, then this will affect the demand for the substitute. I mean, if you look at two products and saying, okay, these are substitutes, we can use this or we can use that. Well, if the price of one changes, that's going to affect the quantity demanded for that, but it'll affect the demand for the substitute. Things that are substitutes, like ice cream and sherbet, for example. Well, if the price of ice cream goes up, then people will tend to buy more sherbet. So the price of ice cream goes up, the quantity demanded goes down, but as people buy less ice cream, then there's a tendency for them to buy more sherbet. So this is how the price of a change in the price of one affects a change in the demand for the other. Okay? Okay, now when we say a change in demand, what we're talking about here is that the whole curve is shifting. A change in demand, you've got to distinguish in your mind the difference between the terms a change in the quantity demanded and a change in demand. If we say there's a change in the quantity demanded, that means that price has changed, we're moving along a stationary curve, and what is changing is on the horizontal axis, which is always quantity. Now, if something changes other than price, then the whole curve will shift. And then we say that there is a change in demand. So a change in demand says, hey, something has changed here other than price. And therefore, the whole curve is going to shift. Okay, so the important thing here is to know the difference between a change in the quantity demanded as price changes and a change in demand when things change other than price. So now what we look at, we say, well, okay, we now know that a change in price will lead to a change in the quantity demanded, but not a change in the curve itself. So what are these things that can change other than price that will cause a change in demand, a shift in the whole curve? Well, there are several things here. I'll just name them briefly and then talk about each one very briefly, because this is, after all, a review of this chapter and not the full-blown lecture. So what are some of those things that can change other than price that will cause a shift in the whole demand curve? Well, the number in the market can change. Consumers' incomes can change. Prices of related goods can change. Consumers' expectations can change. Consumer demographics can change. And/or consumer tastes can change. So let me very quickly talk about these things here. First of all, a change in the number in the market. We realize that the more consumers there are in a market, then there's a tendency for demand to increase. Now, in the market, can you go to a grocery store, look around, don't find what you're looking for, and walk out without paying? I mean, walk out without buying anything. Having to pay, walk out without buying anything. And the answer is yes. Okay, but you were in the market, right? You went to the grocery store, you were in the market, you were looking for something, you couldn't find what you want, or at least you couldn't find it at the price you were willing to pay, and you left without buying anything. So the point here is that not everyone in the market ends up buying. That just means, hey, I'm looking. If I can find what I want at the price I'm willing to pay, I'll buy. Otherwise, I'm not going to buy. Now, what we're saying here is that the more people we have in the market, then there's a tendency for demand increase. The fewer people there are in the market, then the lower demand tends to be. All right, what about consumer income? This is the second thing that can cause a shift in demand curves. What we're talking about here is real income, people's buying power, and as people's incomes increase, then there will be an increase in demand for some things and a decrease in demand for other things. This is why we talked about normal goods and inferior goods. If people's real incomes increase, then they will buy more normal goods, like more new cars. But as their incomes increase, they will buy fewer inferior goods, for example, used cars. And the third thing that can cause a change in demand is the price of related goods. And that's why we talked about goods being related as either substitutes or complements. If two goods are related, and not, you know, of course, not all goods are related, but if two goods are related, then they're related as either being substitutes or complements. So a change in the price of one will affect a change in the demand for the other. Okay, it's just like, with the price of gasoline going up, gasoline and cars are related. You know, they're complements. So as the price of gasoline goes up, then there tends to be an increase in the demand for smaller, fuel-efficient cars. Okay, consumer expectations. We learned here that a very big factor that can cause shifts in demand curves are expectations. And sort of an underlying theme of this whole course is that the perception is always greater than the reality, that people make decisions based on their expectations of what they think is going to happen. If people's expectations change, then that can lead to a change in the demand for some things and a decrease in the demand for the other things. Like if you look at the stock market, for example, if people think that the price of a good is going to go up, then they will, in the future, and maybe in the near future, then they will tend to buy more. But now, because they say, well, if I can buy a low price and then I own it, and then the price goes up, then I gain. Well, what they're basing their decision on here is not what happens or not what exists today, but what they think is going to happen tomorrow. Now, what does consumer demographics mean? Well, demographics is the sort of like the environment. The demographics of Florida is different than the demographics of Michigan. And so therefore, the buying habits of people in Florida would be different than the buying habits of people in Michigan. So that's what we mean by demographics. Consumer taste is the last thing that we look at here that can cause shifts in demand curves, either to the right or to the left. And as consumer tastes change, and in as time goes on, and the only thing that we can really depend upon is change. Consumer tastes change. Fads come and go, and technology changes, and which affects people's decision making. And as consumer tastes and preferences change, then this is reflected in demand curves either moving to the right or moving to the left. Okay, so what we've been looking at here so far is demand. So let me very quickly talk about supply. Because the market, by now is made up of both demand and supply. So what is supply? Well, the definition of supply is really the same as demand, except we're looking at supply curves instead of demand curves. What is supply? A relation showing the quantities of a good producers are willing and able to sell at various prices during a given period, other things constant. See, now that we're looking at supply, we're not looking at people who are demanding, we're looking at people who are supplying. So people who are supplying are the people who are selling. Now, you don't think, though, that all supply curves represent business and all demand curves represent consumers. You know, for example, what group supplies labor? Well, laborers, you know, workers supply labor. Who demands labor? Well, business owners demand labor. So here, you know, we've got a market and we've got demand and supply, and demand represents, you know, the average worker, and supply represents the average worker, and demand represents the business owner. So keep this in mind. But what is always true is that demand curve is looking at those people who are doing the demanding, and the supply curve always represents those people who are doing the supplying. So it's important for you to, have in your mind a distinction between these two. There's two completely, you know, these are two different groups of people, okay? Okay, so now, why are supply curves upward sloping? Now, it's pretty easy to see why demand curves were downward sloping, because, I mean, we knew, okay, the price goes down, people will buy more, and the price goes up, people will buy less. But what about supply curves? I mean, you know, how come is it that as the price goes up, the quantity supplied goes up, which is depicted by a positive slope curve? And as the price goes down, then the quantity supplied goes down. Well, you can only understand this if you truly comprehend that supply represents those people who are doing the supplying. And we always assume that when we change price, nothing else changes. Now, if you were a business owner and you are supplying a certain product, and the price of that product goes up in the market. Now, are you causing the price to go up? No. The market's causing the price to go up. You are the supplier, but the market ultimately determines price. Price is determined by market demand and market supply, all right? Okay, you're the supplier. You put something out there in the market. The market dictates a higher price. What happens to your profits? Well, your profits have got to go up. Why? Because we assumed here that nothing else changed. I mean, the only thing is, you know, your costs haven't changed. You know, I mean, not, you know, nothing's changing. The only thing that's changing here is the price of your product is now going up in the market. And therefore, you've got to be making more money. And because you are in business to make a profit, and you want to be in a place where you're making the most profit, then there's more incentive to you, and the key word here is incentive. As the price goes up, there's more incentive for the supplier to supply more. Why? Because the supplier can make more money at the higher prices. And as the price goes down, less profits are made, so there's incentive now to supply less. So, that's the deal here on supply curves. Now, just with demand curves, when we change price, we always assume that nothing else changes, right? And this is true for both demand and supply. Now, if I say that there's an increase in price, looking at the supply curve, then what we would say is that there is an increase in the quantity supplied. Now, if price goes up, does the supply go up? No, the curve does not change. When price changes, the curve itself does not change. What we're looking at here is price changes. We're moving along a stationary curve, and what's changing is shown on the horizontal axis. Quantity is changing. So price goes up, the quantity supply goes up. The price goes down, the quantity supply goes down, but supply itself does not change. What causes a change in supply? Something has to change other than price. Just like with the demand curves. So what are some of these things that might change other than price that would cause a shift in the supply curve, either to the right or to the left? And so some of the things that can change are technology, prices of relevant resources, prices of alternative goods, producer expectations, and the number of producers in the market. Now, some of these are similar to demand curves. So very, very quickly here, as technology changes, there, of course, is going to be an increase in the supply. I mean, we see this all the time. I mean, you know, there are new inventions coming out, and it becomes very popular, and the supply, of whatever we're looking at here increases. And of course, supply of other things can decrease as technology changes. I mean, some products become outmoded and out of date, and people say, well, because of the change in technology, I don't want to use cassettes anymore. I want to use CDs, and then the internet changes and things. You know, iTunes comes along, and people say, well, I don't want to buy any CDs anymore. I want to just download the music I want from iTunes. So, see, a change in technology here, you see, changes supply. Well, what's prices of relevant resources? Well, relevant resources is if you own a business and you therefore use resources. Different businesses use different resources. Some are labor intensive, and some businesses are capital intensive, for example. Well, if there's a change in the price of a relevant resource, a resource that is relevant to your business, then your supply will either increase or decrease. For example, if you're raising cattle and the price of fertilizer goes up, then you can't you won't fertilize your grass as much, and therefore you won't be able to the supply of cattle that you can raise goes down. If the price of a fertilizer goes down, then you can say, hey, now I can afford to buy more fertilizer. So you fertilize your grass more, your grass grows faster, it's more lush, and on a given acres of land, now you can raise more cattle, and therefore the supply goes up. Prices of alternative goods, what this means is that, again, goods, can be related. Certain goods are related. And so as the price of one good, increases, let me give you an example here in this one. Let's talk about a farmer. Let's say you're a farmer and you've got, 100 acres of land, and in the springtime you've got to decide, okay, what am I going to raise here on this, on this land? I mean, I could, raise many different, this land is good for corn, it's good for beets, it's good for cabbage, it's good for this, it's good for that. So what am I going to plant? You look out and you see, well, the price of corn is going way up. I mean, we got the government passing laws, and we're using corn for ethanol more, and so you say, well, I'll grow more corn. If the price of other products goes down, then you say, well, I'm not gonna grow beets, or I'm not gonna grow cabbage because the price of those are going down. In other words, on this land, the alternative goods is corn, beets, cabbage, or anything else you want to plant. And as the price of these things, these goods change in the market, that's going to affect your decisions on what to grow. Okay, now just like with demand curves, expectations, of course, is very important. Again, if you're a farmer and you've got to decide in the spring what to plant, you know, you don't know for sure, you know, what the market's going to bring in the future, but you can anticipate what you think is going to happen, and then you base decisions on what you think the market is going to be. And so, again, here, you know, expectations is a powerful force that moves markets. Well, the number of producers in the market, you know, that's similar to what we talked about with demand curves. The more producers there are in a certain market, then there's a tendency for supply to increase. The fewer producers, then supply will decrease. Okay, well, very quickly now, again, this is review, so I got to move along very quickly here. But the last part of this chapter, we put demand and supply together, and we talk about the equilibrium. So what happens when we put, you know, the market demand and market supply together? Well, I might say, you know, where is the equilibrium price? Now, what does the equilibrium mean? Equilibrium means a tendency toward, like the equilibrium price is the price toward which the economy tends. Now, we're going to learn here that the equilibrium price in a market is where quantity demanded equals quantity supplied. Now, I might ask you, why is this an equilibrium? And the answer to that is, how do we prove that any point is an equilibrium if it is indeed an equilibrium? Well, what we do is we move away from it and see what happens. By the way, when we move away from the equilibrium point, this is called disequilibrium. So let's do this. If you look at a demand curve, downward sloping demand curve, upper sloping supply curve, price is always on the vertical axis, quantity is always on the horizontal axis. The intersection of quantity demand and quantity supply is the equilibrium. Why is an equilibrium? Because if we go above this price, we're going to have a surplus, and with surpluses, prices will go down. Now, why do we have a surplus? Well, as the price goes up, what do demanders say to themselves? Well, they say, well, we don't want to buy as much. But what do suppliers say to themselves as the price goes up? Well, they say, hey, we want to supply more at these higher prices. Well, with demanders wanting to buy less and suppliers wanting to supply more, we end up with a surplus. And with the surplus, then how do suppliers get rid of the surplus? Well, they lower the price, so price goes down. Now, what happens if we go below the equilibrium price? Well, again here, price goes down, so what do suppliers say to themselves? Hey, we don't want to supply as much, but what do demanders say to themselves? Well, we want to buy more now that the price is lower. Well, with the quantity supply going down and the quantity demand going up, next thing you know, we have a shortage. Now, in a free market, how do we decide who gets and who doesn't get when we have a shortage? Well, people bid against one another, like at an auction, and they bid prices up. So what happens now? Well, the price goes up. So what have we proven here? Well, we've proven that where quantity demanded equals quantity supplied, I mean the price where quantity demanded equals quantity supplied, is an equilibrium price, because if we go above that price, we have shown the price would go down, and if we go below that equilibrium price, price will go up. Now, the last point I want to make about this chapter is, what happens when we relax the everything else being equal assumption and we say, okay, what's going to happen now if something changes other than price? Now, we looked at all those many, you know, those several factors that can change demand curves and several factors can change supply curves. And in reality, these things are always changing because we live in an ever-changing world. So what's happening now is that these demand and supply curves are changing in the market. Well, when demand and supply changes, what happens to the equilibrium price? Well, the equilibrium price will change. because the intersection of quantity matter equals quantity supply changes. So this describes how, you know, why prices change in the market. Okay, well, this concludes chapter 3. I'm going to have to get on here with chapter 4 because it looks like we've got maybe about 15, at the most 20 minutes here. So let me go on to chapter 4. Chapter 4 is on economic decision makers. And what your author does in this chapter is that he sort of gives you an overview of the different participants in markets. The different participants in markets are households, you know, that we look at as consumers, businesses, governments, both federal, state, and local, and foreigners. And so what he does now is he says, well, now, if we're really going to understand, you know, how markets work and, you know, understand, you know, the economy, we have to have some idea of you know, who these people are. And so and what are some changes that have taken place over the recent past, you know, considering these, you know, different decision makers in the economy. So the first group that we're going to look at is households. And so what your author does, he says, well, now, how is a household, I mean, what is the characteristic of the, you know, typical household, and how have households changed, you know, over the recent past? What are some trends? What are some fundamental changes? Well, the first thing he talks about is the increase in the two income family. You know, after World War II, during the 50s, 40s, late 40s, 50s, and even into the 60s, the norm was one income in a household. You know, usually that was the you know, the husband and father, and, you know, he worked full time, and the wife and mother was home, and that was the norm. I mean, that, you know, there were working wives back then, working mothers, you know, back then, even in the, you know, 50s, but the norm was that you had you know, one income in the family, and then things changed to where the norm became the two income family. Well, what changed? I mean, what, you know, I mean, there's always a reason why things like this happen. So one of the big changes here was the inflation and of the 1970s. Now, the decade of the 1970s is characterized by what we call stagflation, that the economy was stagnating, meaning we had increasing unemployment and inflating at the same time. In fact, in 1970s, the average inflation rate was about 10% a year. Now, a 10% increase annually, prices will double in just 7 years. And so you say, okay, now if we're in a situation here where prices are doubling, how many people's incomes are doubling every 7 years? Well, maybe not that many. Plus, we have an increase in unemployment. So where does this put the average family? Well, this puts the average family between a rock and a hard place. I mean, even if the job situation hasn't changed, you know, our income's not keeping up with the rise in prices, and maybe now because of the increase in unemployment, well, if we're not totally unemployed, at least we're working fewer hours, or maybe even our pay has been cut. So now we're really hurt. I mean, now we're doubly hurt because we're making less, perhaps, and yet we're having to, every time we buy something, we're having to pay more. Well, so what's the answer? Well, the answer, of course, is, you know, I mean, if we start from the fact that you only have one income in the family, then the answer would be, Well, maybe that, you know, second person can go out into the workforce and help the family out financially. And so that's what happened. Now, in the beginning, many of these families thought this was a temporary thing because, I mean, after all, I mean, you know, what they've been used to is, you know, one-income families, and they, you know, they liked that. They were kind of comfortable with that idea. But so they said, well, you know, this is just a temporary thing. But, of course, it turned out to be more than temporary because once we had, you know, wives and mothers going into the workforce, and, you know, instead of saving, you know, this extra income and paying off her bills, what a lot of families did, well, they just increased their lifestyle. You know, they bought a bigger home and, you know, bought, you know, a second car and you know, they just upped their lifestyle. And so they became dependent on that second income. And so instead of, you know, the wife and mother going, you know, quitting their job after 2 or 3 years, you know, coming back home full time, she just continued to work. Well, this brings us to another point, and that is once these working mothers, you know, became apparent that their situation was permanent rather than temporary, they want to make more income. Because to begin with, it was the husband and you know, father who had the, you know, the most education and higher paying jobs. And when the wives and mothers had to go into the workforce for the first time without the education, they were by and large low income type jobs. And so they said, well, now if we're going to be working here, then at least we want to make it worth our while. And so they started to go back to college. I mean, even today, you know, the majority of college students are female all across the nation. And this led to a higher, you know, higher pay, of course, for females. Well, this whole thing, of course, changed households dramatically, because we're talking here, you know, more about, I mean, much, there's more than money involved here, and in fact, we've got two incomes, that these two income families, their lifestyles dramatically changed. And you know, with the two incomes, they it just, you know, people ate out more. The way they interacted with one another changed. I mean, it changed the whole, you know, the fundamental aspect of the of marriages changed because of the two income families becoming the norm. Okay. Let's leave the household sector now and talk a little bit about the business sector. The business sector it can be divided up into sole proprietorships, partnerships, and corporations. These are different types of business organizations. And the sole proprietorship is a firm with a single owner who has a right to all profits and who bears unlimited liability for the firm's debts. And most businesses in America are sole proprietorships. You don't have to have a license, you know, or a tax number to have a sole proprietorship. You can use your social security number. It's a very simple type of business. The income of the business, however, it can't be distinguished from your personal income in the sole proprietorship, tax-wise. But the business, most businesses are sole proprietorships, but the amount of income earned by these sole proprietorships are much lower than other types of business organizations because even though there are many of them, the volume of business is smaller in terms of the sole proprietor than like with, you know, major corporations. In other words, there are fewer major corporations as business entities, but they deal in much larger dollar volumes. Now, when, you know, if you have a sole proprietorship, when would you consider forming a corporation? Well, you would consider forming a corporation because of liability issues. If you have a business and you know, there's chances that you know you could be liable for certain things, then you can form a corporation. A small business can form like an S corporation or a limited liability corporation. And for what purpose? Well, the whole purpose of corporations is that a corporation is a legal entity. For example, I know of a person that owned a gas station as a sole proprietor. Someone slipped and fell on a grease slick in his driveway there, and in his gas station, and broke their back and sued him, and he lost everything. I mean, his business, his house, his wife left him, because of all this. And now, what could he have done? Well, for a measly, $100, he could have formed a corporation, and that would have separated his personal assets from his business assets. So that if he were sued, maybe he would have lost his business, but his house and his car and his personal assets would have been protected because they are now legally separate from his business. And that is what corporations are all about. Corporations are all about forming legal entities as if they were real persons, but they're not. They're legal entities. So in the eyes of the law, they're like people. They have a personality, separate from the personal assets of the owners. And so anyway, that's the whole purpose of business organizations like corporations. Well, let's move on to the second economic decision maker. I mean, I'm sorry, not the second, but the third. We talked about the household, and then we talked about the business sector. So now let's talk about the government sector. And you might say, well, I believe that the less government we have, the better. Free markets should be free of, government entanglements. Well, the truth of the matter is that a free enterprise system can only function with a strong central government. Now, that doesn't mean that we're going to have a government that's going to dictate, what to produce and who gets what and how much. But in order for a free enterprise system to flourish, government can provide us with the stability and the framework of which we can prosper. And so very quickly here, let's look at, I'm just going to mention a lot of these things. Why do we need government? In a free market, free enterprise system, why do we need government? Well, the first is that we need government to establish and enforce rules of the game. The market can be like playing a game, and we need order. And we need to establish rules, and we need to have a way to enforce these rules in order to have this order. Businesses have to be able to enter into contracts, and knowing that those contracts will be honored, in order for us to have a viable business setting. Another reason that we need government is. Sometime we need laws that can promote competition. When one business maybe becomes very large and then they become a monopoly, they have a great deal of market power, and then they make decisions to benefit themselves, more than the market. We need government to say, hey, this is unfair. We have to have ample competition here so that people have choices. And so we've got laws here to make sure that there's ample competition in these markets so that no one business, can monopolize the whole market. We need government to provide us with public goods, things like public education and roads is a perfect example of a public good. So the certain things can work best if we tax, and the only way that we can tax is to have a government. So okay, we've got a government. Government taxes. They take this tax money, and then they use this tax money to provide us with public education. They use this tax money to provide us with an adequate road system, and national defense and things of that nature. And all of these things are necessary, you know, for a free enterprise system to flourish. We also need the government to help us deal with negative externalities, you know, like pollution. You know, without government enforcement here of certain environmental laws, we would have serious pollution problems. And so these are what are called negative externalities. Pollution is a negative externality. It's external from the system, and it's not intended, but it is the result of the productive process. And we need government to have laws that make sure everything, you know, businesses are competing on a level playing field and put some effort into cleaning up the environment. Okay, we also need government to promote a more equal distribution of income. You know, without government, very few people would have a whole lot, and very a lot of people would have very little, and at least that could happen. And so one of the functions of government is to tax and then, you know, transfer money from people who have money to people that are less fortunate and to help them, you know, like Social Security, of course, and unemployment benefits and, you know, other type of government programs. And sometime we need government to help us in during times of economic need, you know, that we need government to strive for full employment, price stability, and economic growth. And later, you know, in this course, we look at monetary policies and fiscal policies. And, how governments and the Federal Reserve, can have an influence on promoting economic growth and full employment. Okay, so that takes care of the government sector. The foreign sector here is the fourth sector of the decision makers, and so why does international trade occur? Because the opportunity cost of producing specific good differs among countries. The fact is that the world's resources are not evenly distributed around the globe. And therefore, it's necessary for us to trade with other countries in order for us to have the high standard of living that we now enjoy. Now, if we did not trade with other nations, could Americans survive? Well, yeah, maybe. You know, of course. You know, we're a very large country. We've got a lot of natural resources. Highly capitalized, highly educated, and we could certainly survive without trading with other nations. But could we live as well as we do? I mean, could the average family have the standard of living they presently enjoy without trading with other nations? And the answer to that question is definitely no. That if we did not trade with other nations, the average family would experience a much, much lower standard of living. And so in order for us to take advantage of the fact that the world's resources are not evenly distributed around the globe, we have to trade with other nations, and therefore this greatly enhances economic growth. Okay, well, this was